All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Your source for clear thinking Christianity every week, Sundays 3 until 5, or in this case 3 until 4:45, for the rest of this month. And then January, I guess we start extending again. We're back to 2 hours. So this is really just about the last short show of the year. Entirely. I guess we've got a couple more weeks in December. And you turn to the right place because we've got some incredible conversations ahead of us here today. And the lines are open here, but with qualification, because I want you to be able to call in with regards to the conversation this next hour about Mormonism in a very particular kind of way. My guest, Dr. Craig Hazen, will be talking with him in just a moment about their event on the 14th of November on Temple Mount, as it were, in Salt Lake City. Before I get to that, though, just something I want to mention, and that is last night I went to the very best Christmas show I have ever been to. And to be honest with you, my wife and I needed this. We drove more than an hour, hour and a half, actually, given traffic, to John MacArthur's church, Grace Community Church, in Panorama City. And if you are within striking distance of this church and you don't have any to-die-for plans tonight, go to this event. 6 o'clock, it's the last one running. It's about an hour and a half. It's all music with a short vignette by John himself on the Nativity. And he does a very sweet job talking about Jesus and the cross and the context of our culture right now. And he made a comment there, which was really apropos. He said, you know, isn't it nice? And he gives his little talk about three-quarters of the way through the presentation, which is all music, other than his comments. And he said, isn't it nice to just to be able to come to an old-fashioned Christmas program? And it wasn't all hyped up. It was just so sensational. Now, one other thing I got to mention, this is a huge church, and as such, in Panorama City, attracts, you know, a lot of skilled people. And so two of the little segments, they had a number of performers with a big orchestra and a huge choir, but individual performing groups or individuals who just got up, sang a song, and sat down, or played an instrumental. In this case, Christopher Parkening, arguably the best classical guitarist in the world since Segovia died, does two numbers, walks up, does his numbers, nods to the audience, and then walks down, and then more. And in fact, there was another fellow named Jubilant, his first name was Jubilant something, I can't remember his last name, an African-American man that did a rendition of Mary, Did You Know, that I am getting choked up now just thinking about it. This was so powerful, I couldn't even clap at the end. I was weeping so much. And that wasn't the only presentation that brought me to tears. If you can possibly go, please go. John MacArthur's church, Grace Community Church, go on the internet, find out the address. You got to be there by 5:30 if you want a seat at 6 and get parking and all of that. It's a big mess down there in terms of people. Get there early, go to it. I'd even want to go back again if I didn't have plans tonight, and frankly, I can't get down there in time anyway from the show. But you can. I did it last night. I hope you do it this night. Just a commercial on behalf of your spiritual life, all right? I'm not employed by MacArthur's Church or anything like that, but I think you will not regret this. Grace Community Church, Panorama City, 6 o'clock tonight. Now, my guest, a dear friend, a former chairman of the board at Stand to Reason, and still on our board, director of the apologetics program at Biola University, the master's program there. Many of you people have either been enrolled in the program or at least gone to some of the courses there, and has been making a tremendous impact through the training of others for the cause of Christ as ambassadors for Christ in that apologetics program. Dr. Craig Hazen. Craig, it's great to have you here today.
Great to be here.
You are doing so many more things, though, and have been for a while, than just what's going on in at Biola, which everybody is familiar with. A couple of weeks ago, I read some of your emails to kind of your friends about what was going on in Temple Mount, and you described the events of November 14th, 6 weeks ago, 2004, in the LDS Temple Square in Salt Lake City. In fact, in the Mormon Tabernacle itself, seats 7,000 people, as a, and here are your words, a spiritual earthquake that will be featured prominently in history books 100 years from now.
It has that potential.
Tell us what happened, what led up to it, and what happened 6 weeks ago in Salt Lake City.
Well, you know, there really is a long story with regard to this. Let me start with the actual event itself. There hadn't been an evangelical preaching from the pulpit in the Mormon tabernacle for 100 years. I think Dwight Moody was the last one to do it. So to have somebody wander in there and actually give a robust gospel message centered on the true Jesus Christ right in the heart of the Mormon world was just phenomenal. And of course, the speaker that evening was Ravi Zacharias, and he pulls absolutely no punches. But what led up to this? I mean, the first thing people ask me when I mention this is, well, how did that happen? How did you get in there to do that? Well, I didn't do it. You know, I didn't organize the event. I was glad to participate and be involved. But a friend of mine named Greg Johnson, who's a pastor in Utah, has been befriending Mormons in Salt Lake. He's a former Mormon himself for years. And his method of operation is to build relationships with them in order to present the gospel through lifestyle and through word and deed.
In fact, his ministry is called Standing Together Ministries.
That's right.
And doesn't he kind of go on the road with another Mormon, a Robert Millett of Brigham Young University, and kind of do a dialogue all around the country?
He does. In fact, Bob Millett was at the event at the Tabernacle on the 14th of November. And Bob Millett's probably one of the top theologians in the Mormon Church. Mormons don't have theologians. They're kind of proud of the idea that they don't have theologians. But if they did have one, Robert Millett would be one of them. And he and Greg Johnson go around to various secular university campuses, sometimes to Mormon steakhouses and wards, and sometimes evangelical churches, and dialogue together. These are not debates. These are not meant for one party to come out victorious, but they're meant to show that we can actually talk about such things.
Now, at these kinds of discussions, though, are there is there a clear characterization of the differences between Mormonism and evangelical Protestant Christianity?
There is. I mean, I've heard a couple of them. I'd like it to be a little bit stronger at times. But nonetheless, I think the more important thing is just that they're modeling talking with one another, and we haven't been very good at that.
So this kicks off kind of a relationship between evangelicals and LDS, especially Brigham Young, academics between Mormonism and Christianity, and this begins to grow as more people are added to the mix,
including yourself. There's been a dialogue going on for a number of years. It's been kind of a backdoor thing where a number of evangelical academics have been getting together with some of the senior religion faculty at BYU and talking turkey over some very difficult doctrinal issues. It has been, I think it's been monumental.
And Frank Beckwith is part of that too, isn't
he? He's actually not been part of those dialogues, but he's in the always been in the background.
Yeah, because I know he was the author of the New Mormon Challenge, or he one of the authors there.
Yeah, he participated in that very important book, The New Mormon Challenge, which came out just as our dialogues were getting underway, and actually didn't
help. Is that what you're going to say?
It threw some difficult fodder into the mix, you know, because we had to sort that out. You know, some of the folks on the BYU side weren't too happy of us having a kind of quote anti-Mormon book on the shelf. Although they had to admit, you know, this has a different sound to it. You guys treat us with respect in this book, but you're still, you know, you still got the arguments wrong. By the way, that book is sold at the BYU, the Brigham Young University bookstore.
No kidding.
Yeah. It's one of the only, quote, anti-Mormon books that's sold there.
Right, right. Well, that's what troubles me a little bit about this discussion, though, coming from this side, is that whenever you try to make even an even-handed, non-bellicose critique of their beliefs, it's immediately characterized as anti-Mormon hate. Not, I don't know if hate speech is the word they use, but certainly anti-Mormon books and the like, which feature, which detail, which history here is going to work into some concerns about even the meeting you had a couple of weeks ago.
That is a very important insight. There's this term anti-Mormon. It's even in the Mormon Encyclopedia. You can look it up and find out what they mean by anti-Mormon. And we have to actually pay very close attention to what they mean by that, because I think there's a psychology involved in the LDS, the way they approach us. When we go after them in certain styles, like the, quote, anti-Mormon style. And sometimes it's just telling the truth about their history, but nonetheless, it's a way of approaching the dialogue. They shrink back and are affirmed, because I think they're taught, even when they're very young in the LDS church, that this is the way you're going to be treated out there, and you should expect it, because, you know, the people of the Restoration are going to encounter that kind of opposition.
And Jesus was persecuted, you can expect the same. And so just in virtue of what they view as persecution, this this dialogue against their view, then that reaffirms the truthfulness of their own faith in their own mind. Right?
And I've been part of the counter-cult community for years. You know, I studied under Walter Martin and the gang, and I hold that stuff dear, you know, what I've learned from the Gerald and Sandra Tanner and Walter Martin and the gang.
And your PhD is in comparative religions.
Comparative religions with a special focus on new religious movements in America. So I know something of the terrain, but this has been the most important methodological step forward I've ever taken. And it, rather than confronting them immediately on the hardest questions I can find, I build a relationship with them. I disarm them. This is right out of the Stand to Reason playbook, you know?
I see you set me up now. I can't complain too much anymore in this interview. But you're right, you know, being a winsome ambassador for Christ.
Yeah, let me give you an example. I just finished a special course on Mormonism at Biola. We had I taught it among the Torrey Honors Institute students. So I had juniors and seniors, some of the brightest bulbs I've ever encountered. And we just spent we ran it kind of like a graduate seminar where we read almost only Mormon works and discussed them and tried to make sense of this movement. Well, in the course of that, we brought in local Mormon leaders. And I said, okay, students, we're going to use a particular methodology when we encounter these folks. And what we're going to do is we're going to treat them like kings when they walk into our midst. We're going to give them cookies. We're going to ask them about their families. We're going to give them a Biola bottle of water and a sweatshirt. And then we're going to have the harder dialogue. And let's see what happens. The students were stunned how open these guys were. They were so excited to talk to a group. They said, are you sure this is Biola? We heard you guys didn't like Mormons. Well, it's not that we don't like Mormons. We do have some problem with your teaching. And then we spent about an hour and a half just talking about the Trinity. I got an email back from one of these top institute leaders in Southern California, an LDS man. He said, I had no idea what you guys really meant by the Trinity until I spent that hour and a half with you. This is something I need to think seriously about, because I thought the Trinity was something you folks constructed. Rather, it's something that you think emerges from the Bible, and you've named it the Trinity. So it's your effort to make sense of Scripture.
Right. Exactly.
I said, bingo.
Yeah.
We are making progress now.
Now, are these churchmen or are these academics the ones that you talk to? Because that's two different groups of people.
Yeah, there are many different strata in the LDS Church.
And that's true even in evangelicalism. Yeah.
Now, these would be some of the top lay leaders. They're not academics, but they teach in an LDS institute, which sits outside of various colleges. And LDS students from these colleges go to these institutes to sort of get their LDS teachings.
Okay, so then you have this interaction, and this is characteristic of what you're doing now with the leadership, which has been building over how much period of time to this event, November 14th?
Yeah, 5 or 6 years. But let me add one other element. So we've had these dialogues going with the Brigham Young University faculty. We've had lots of new kinds of interaction where we're befriending them and building relationships and having tough talks. But Greg Johnson did one other thing that I think helped a great deal lay the groundwork in Salt Lake City.
This is from Standing Together Ministries.
Yes, right? Pastor Greg Johnson in Utah. He got together groups of people, rather than to protest outside General Conference. General Conference is a twice yearly meeting that the Mormons have to hear from their leaders, the prophet and the apostles and so on. And generally there are Christians protesting out there, you know, holding up signs with websites on them. And I appreciate that approach. I mean, I think we need several different approaches going here. Greg Johnson and his crew tried something different. They actually lined up, they got a group of maybe, 75 to 100 Christians in the Salt Lake area, lined up, gave the people water bottles on their way in and said, we're just here to greet you.
No kidding.
There was a security guard in Temple Square came up to them afterwards and said, I've been here 30 years, I've seen every kind of protest you could imagine. I have never seen anything like this. Never. And I guess tears were coming to his eyes. He was saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? This resonated with the leadership of the Mormon Church. So when Greg Johnson one day says, you know, I'm going to invite Ravi Zacharias to town. I wonder if we can have this little event in the LDS Tabernacle, you know, one of the most famous sites in the LDS world. So he writes a letter to the First Presidency, that is the the top officers in the church, and he almost fell to the ground when he got his response that, yes, indeed, you can have your event in our tabernacle. Greg Johnson got to meet with President Hinckley along with Ravi Zacharias, and Greg asked, why? You know, how come you let us have your tabernacle for this important event? He said, that Hinckley said, well, we just wanted to be helpful.
Hmm.
You know, it sounded like a good idea.
Now, did he know that Greg Johnson was the one who had given out the water?
Yes.
That, so there was that connection.
You
being,
bet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just want to be helpful.
Yeah,
there's like, almost like a little quid pro quo. Well, you give us some water, we'll give you the tabernacle.
Yes, but get this. I mean, if you think about this, what this method leads to, it opens up the tabernacle for Ravi Zacharias to give, an hour and 15 minute hard-hitting message about the true gospel and the true Christ.
Hmm.
Now, if people were looking for the big turnaround, a unified repentance in the Mormon church, it wasn't going to happen that night. But we need to take play after play and see a victory when we've got one. And that was pushing the ball forward in a significant way.
That's a first down.
That's right.
And this is, I'm glad that you brought this particular point up, because some of the question that people have raised have to do with what your goals are regarding this this long-term discussion that you're having, which came to a head in a major highlight 6 weeks ago on November 14th. But what actual impact are you having? Apparently, the Mormon Church hasn't abandoned its teachings yet, and so some would see this as kind of a, not even a modest victory, but not a victory at all, because they don't see these other kinds of things happening yet. And your response?
Well, I think we need to be in it for the long haul. Mm-hmm. And I'm much more optimistic than a lot of folks who are in the trenches. And maybe it's because I'm in kind of an academic perch, although I work in the trenches too, so I have a foot in both worlds. But I've studied the history and development of Mormon thought. And in my view, they are changing, and they've got mechanisms in place to continue these kinds of doctrinal transformations.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be wherever I can where these deliberations are taking place about what they're going to change next. I'd like to give my opinion on where they ought to go.
Give them a piece of your mind on that one, right. And I know that part of your group, you mentioned Greg Johnson, and we're going to talk about Richard Mao in a minute, Ravi Zacharias. Michael Card was there as a Christian singer as part of that event.
That was dynamite.
And but also Joseph Tkach was there. Now, he's important for a different reason.
That was an amazing symbol. He gave the opening prayer. Joseph Tkach is the pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God. And if your listeners know, that was a classic cult started by Herbert W. Armstrong, that when the leaders of that church, after the passing of Armstrong, began to look more closely at the Bible, they discovered that God is a Trinity.
Right.
And they began to teach this, and it caused earthquakes in their midst and a great deal of pain.
Mm-hmm.
But the leaders held the sound doctrine, promulgated it, and look where they are today. They have joined the National Association of Evangelicals, and we generally consider them an Orthodox church.
Great. So, Joseph Tkach Jr. now, who is the head of the Worldwide Church of God, following in the steps of his father, who was one of the change agents, as I understand it. Here he's kind of giving aid and support to your enterprise because he understands what it takes to turn somebody around. Now, that was compared to the Mormon Church, this is a very small organization.
Right.
And that was still an earthquake kind of move. First time it ever happened where you have a arguably a cult of Christianity becoming Orthodox. And so since that took a long time, might take maybe, a generation? Our lifetime for
it's
something like
this,
the Mormon Church.
This is minimally a generational project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talking with Craig Hazen, Dr. Craig Hazen of Talbot, or rather Biola. I get the two mixed up because they're kind of like twins joined at the hip a little bit, but runs the master's program there and did great work over at Simon Greenleaf where I got my master's degree, my first master's degree before that. And talking about the earthquake event that they had at the Mormon Tabernacle 6 weeks ago where Ravi Zacharias spoke. Will, the lines are open here. If you'd like to call in, 1-800-227-5278, although you call in at your own risk because I can't guarantee you that I'll break away from Craig long enough to get your call, but maybe we will. We have more to talk about this, find out what actually took place, how they responded, and the really massive controversy that has come out of this effort. And we'll hear Dr. Hazen's responses to that when we return right here on Stand to Reason.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues. including making decisions. Decision Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And just a reminder, coming up around the corner, just a few weeks away, our Master Series of Christian Thought. We do that every spring and have partnered with Hope Chapel on that for many years now. We get some of the best thinkers that we can get to talk with you and share their minds with you about the cultural circumstances and how ambassadors for Christ enter into that. Starting out January 10th at Hope Chapel, 7 o'clock, Dr. William Lane Craig kicking it off. He usually does for us in our Master Series. And then the week after that, January 17th, these are Monday nights, Hugh Hewitt is going to show up. And that's we're thrilled about his future appearance at our Master Series. He'll be talking about his influential book, In But Not Of, How Christians Can Have an Influence on the World. That one, by the way, starts at 7:30, but just come at 7 because that's going to be a filled auditorium and you want to get good seats. Actually, come before 7. The week after that, Dr. James White on the authority of Scripture. Can we trust this book? J.P. Moreland reprising his annual visit to us at the Master Series with Truth or Experience, Why Postmodernism is Incompatible with Christianity. And then on February 7th, I'll be anchoring the series talking about same-sex marriage and what the Bible has to say about such. And I hope you can make it out. Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. Go to our website at str.org for full information. January 10th through February 7th, 7 to 9:30 pretty much. That's the hours there. And hope to see you there for the Master's Series of Christian Thought. Talking with Craig Hazen from Biola University and the event that he participated in on Temple Mount in the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, with 7,000 sellout auditorium, where Ravi Zacharias, the first Protestant speaker in 100 years to speak there, gave this powerful teaching on the person of Jesus Christ. Tell us more about the event, Craig, and how it was received, how that message was received, and how people reacted to it.
It was an electric event, and I imagine that there were one-third to one-half LDS, that is Latter-day Saints, in the audience. And you have to picture this. This is a very ancient building in terms of Utah, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And up on stage are sitting a row of pastors from the Salt Lake Valley. I think that in itself was a tremendous symbol of a unity that the Mormons think doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they think that the reason the Restoration, led by Joseph Smith, had to take place is because Christians are so divided on everything. They can't agree on anything. They need authority. They need a teacher with authority, a prophet, to lead them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here are these pastors sitting up there in a unified way. And then up gets Joseph Tkach, pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God, to give the opening prayer. That was a dynamic symbol, saying, mm-hmm. This is our hope for you, that you will come to the true fold.
Now, you're saying that's the statement of the symbol, as you read it, but
that's
he
right.
Didn't say those things.
No,
in
he
his
did
prayer.
Not.
Okay,
yeah.
Just for clarification's sake.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was a great symbol.
Michael Card?
Michael Card played about 5 songs, and that was electric. I mean, there were Christians standing up and worshiping the Lord inside the LDS Tabernacle.
Anybody break out in tongues, as far as you know?
As far as I know, no.
Right? And then Ravi gave his keynote message.
He did. Before that, though, couple of controversial parts. Robert Millett of Brigham Young University got up and said about 8 minutes worth of remarks. And then Richard Mao got up and said about...
By the way, Robert Millett would be the other half of this dialogue with the Christian pastor, Greg Johnson, right? That's where
right.
Robert comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Richard Mao, and if you want to say something about it, we will be getting to this in more detail in a moment.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Yeah, Rich Mao gave about 8 minutes worth of remarks that certainly characterize the event. I mean, that's what you're reading about in the Salt Lake newspapers about Richard Mao's remarks. And, well, it's unfortunate that those ended up characterizing the evening, which was a huge push forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has opened doors that are really significant.
Yeah.
And we can't wait to see what's going to come next. But unfortunately, you know, some other controversies have arisen.
Right. Let's talk about that in a moment. His remarks, because they've raised some questions from the Christian cult community. But tell us about what Ravi, because this is the heart of the event, really, an hour and 15
yes.
minutes of theology from one of the best communicators of our age, Ravi Zacharias.
Right. You know, I was sitting on stage with some of the BYU, Brigham Young University professors who are my counterparts in these dialogues
mm-hmm.
we've been having. And to hear Ravi give a dynamite presentation of Jesus, the state of human beings, the depravity of man, you know, all of which, by the way, goes against traditional Mormon teaching.
Mm.
I mean, most of the people in the audience, if they were LDS, didn't know that Ravi was stepping on their toes. They
mm-hmm.
just don't know enough about their own teaching.
There's a sense in which they're much like evangelicals
yes.
today, churchgoers, Christians who are biblically illiterate. They are Mormon illiterate after a fashion.
That's right.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and so Ravi could talk about this, you know, this huge gap between man and God, this unbridgeable gap, and even the Mormons were cheering, you
mm-hmm.
know, and they don't actually teach that.
Mm-hmm.
But so I was just delighted that they were hearing this kind of teaching, and Ravi painted the picture that human beings are just hopeless in their own state. They've got to completely rely on the grace of Christ
mm-hmm.
alone. That's it. That's the only hope. And even the LDS in the audience were cheering at that.
Mm-hmm.
What a remarkable opportunity to present that gospel.
Of course, your academics knew better.
Yeah, there were some BYU professors on stage. Now, at BYU, this has actually become a fairly standard teaching, that you can only be saved by grace alone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to parse all the words whenever we get into that kind
right.
of discussion. But nonetheless, this redemptive theology is kind of a new wave of teaching in the Mormon
mm-hmm.
church.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have a problem with that. But Ravi did start to talk about God and God and the Trinity. And even the Mormons in the audience, I think, were cheering at that one, because I don't think they knew the difference. But
mm-hmm.
some of the BYU profs, they were sitting a little more stoically at
mm-hmm.
that point.
Because mm-hmm. for us, this is a metaphysical statement about the character of God.
Yes.
For them, it's about a kind of a family of individuals that have some relationship to each other, because according to strict Mormon doctrine, Jesus is really no different metaphysically than we are. As I understand it.
Yeah. I get nervous anytime somebody talks about strict Mormon doctrine. There is no such thing generally. You know, they're all over the map on these
mm-hmm.
questions. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I can ask the professors at BYU. I can ask missionaries at the door. I can ask high-level institute teachers a simple question like, how many gods are there?
Mm-hmm.
How many gods are there? I get a different answer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not willing to sign up with a bunch who can't answer that most basic of questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That they are deeply confused on some of the most important questions about God. And I think this comes out in some of our dialogues, both at the BYU level and at the street level, too. And I think they really want to sort of sort these things out. So it seems to me...
But so Joseph Smith had answers to those questions, though. Are you saying that these are answers that that the Mormon Church now don't hold to as crisply or cleanly or unequivocally, even though they don't want to say at the same time that they're going against what Joseph Smith actually said?
Well, they're even questioning whether Joseph Smith, you know, was speaking for God at certain times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're running around with certain set of facts, you know, certain set of utterances from Joseph Smith that the Mormons are actually pushing into the background now,
mm-hmm.
saying he may not have been speaking for God at that particular
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've got a lot of dynamism, a lot of change going on in their own midst, trying to figure out who said what and what's authoritative. This
mm-hmm.
is a moment to have influence on them.
How do you think the Mormons that you talked to actually responded overall to this evening presentation? And given that some are thinking they're hearing their same own doctrine being articulated maybe more powerfully by a Protestant thinker, do you think Did this really move the project forward theologically, I guess, is what I'm asking?
I think less so theologically, just the event itself, but it was a fantastic symbol mm-hmm. that we can actually get together and talk about these important things rather than just argue at the door with the young missionaries. The symbol was tremendous. I think it just gave the Mormon leadership an idea that maybe we don't have to be so guarded in mm-hmm. our talks with evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're more receptive now to our ideas mm-hmm. because
okay.
of this.
Well, let's go from there yeah. to this next thing, because you mentioned in your own words this is a spiritual earthquake. I think that probably that's a phrase that some in the counter-cult Christian community would characterize it as well, but in the pejorative. That is, that some of the things that were said, particularly by Richard Mao, who's the president of Fuller Seminary, really set some people off. And I don't know if this next caller speaks to that. Let's go to our caller here, and maybe he can offer his thoughts, and this might launch us into this particular point. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I do kind of speak for that, but I am hoping that you guys maybe can set my cynicism straight and help me out here, because I'm a little bit skeptical whenever I see any hints of ecumenicism there, ecumenical mm-hmm. movements. And mm-hmm. so I saw some of these quotes that Richard Mao said, where he said basically, let me state it clearly, we have sinned against you. And, you know, I don't know if he speaks for me on that. And then he also said that we should celebrate Joseph Smith's birthday and other events like that along with Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
The 200th anniversary is coming.
Robert, I have the Richard Mao's comments here, not all 8 minutes of it, but I think the relevant section. So let me, just for the sake of clarity, read
sure.
his words, particularly these are the words that I think have caused so much concern. He says, I'm now convinced, after, you know, referring to his own behind-the-scenes discussions with LDS leaders, okay, then he says, I'm now convinced that we evangelicals have often seriously misrepresented the beliefs and practices of the Mormon community. Indeed, let me state it bluntly to the LDS folks here this evening, we have sinned against you. The God of the Scriptures makes it clear that it's a terrible thing to bear false witness against our neighbors, and we have been guilty of that sort of transgression in the things we have said about you. We have told you what you believe without making a sincere effort, first of all, to ask you what you believe. We have made much of the need to provide you with a strong defense of traditional Christian convictions, regularly quoting Apostle Peter's mandate to present to the people a reason to counter the hope that lies within us, but we have not been careful to follow the same apostle's counsel that immediately follows that mandate when he tells us that we must always make our case with gentleness and reverence towards those with whom we're speaking. Indeed, we have even on occasion demonized you, weaving conspiracy theories about what the LDS community is really trying to accomplish in the world. And even at our best, we have, and this is true of both our communities, we have talked past each other, setting forth oversimplified and distorted accounts of what the other group believes. That, I think, captures the heart of the concessionary apology that Richard Mao made to LDS, and has really got the Christian cult, counter-cult community up in arms there. These are the statements that you're concerned with as well, Robert?
Yeah, I am. I am concerned with
it. Do you feel like he misrepresented? Are you involved in counter-cult ministry with Mormons?
Personally by myself, I've been doing that for many years, where I talk to missionaries and set up little talks with them and invite them to my apologetics Bible study and things like that. I've been doing it personally for a long time.
Would you say that there's any truth to anything that Richard Mao said?
Yes, I think it is true that many evangelicals have misrepresented the Mormon faith.
In what sense would that be?
Saying certain statements that doctrinally saying that they might believe something when it's, you know, there's a lot of dumb evangelicals who don't know what they believe.
Right.
They don't even know what they believe. How do they
right.
know what Mormons believe?
Right.
That is true. There is truth to that. There is truth to that.
Would you say, okay, with that in mind, and I want to hear from Dr. Hazen in just a minute, but would you say that the phrase bearing false witness is an appropriate way to describe what evangelicals have done in your view?
Yes.
Okay, because keep in mind that bearing false witness seems to entail the notion of intent to deceive. Intent to deceive. In other words, they knew they were bearing false witness, yet they did it. They were lying, essentially. And I see that as something different than somebody being maybe responsibly mistaken for misunderstandings they have about Mormonism. It's one thing to say you didn't do your homework and you should have. It's another thing to say you knew one thing, but you represented another. And I think that's the way people are responding to the phrase false witness here. What do you think? Craig, do you think that's what Richard Mouw had in view here? Or is that, do you think that's the way that Mormons took it?
Yeah, I'm not sure what he had in mind there. Mm-hmm. That puzzled me, because I know what you mean by the intentional aspect of bearing false witness.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably more guilty of not taking the time to understand what Mormons really mm-hmm. believe and presenting it accurately.
No, I think, and Robert, I'm interested in what you have to say about this too. Craig, I think that part of this is legitimate simply because of what you said just a moment ago, unwilling to say this is what Mormons believe because there's tremendous flux. Now, if this is true,
yes.
This puts every Mormon cult apologist at a disadvantage, because you've got to defend your view over to get another set of views, which is constantly changing. You could always be said to be misrepresenting somebody's view if it's constantly in flux that way. What do you think, Robert?
I think that's a wonderful point, and I would agree with your clarification on false witness. I think I misspoke. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's one thing just to be an ignorant Christian. It's another thing to go just willingly deceive. But my main problem with the event was with some of the quotes I read in the articles of people, Mormons who had left the event. They said they loved the focus on unity, and it was real beautiful. And in my personal witnessing with Mormons, when they leave and they think we had a great time and they're really cheery, it's usually the case that they didn't get offended in any way. I'm not out to offend them, but it tends...
They didn't get offended in the right way is what you're saying, for
yeah,
the right reasons,
yeah.
Right?
And all these people focus on unity. And the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 said there must be divisions among you so that mm-hmm. the truth will be made evident. And so not that I like to go out and cause division and everything. I want people to respect me and, mm-hmm. I don't want to fight. But I don't want them to walk away and just say, oh, we had this great love fest.
Sure, sure. Let me take this to Dr. Hazen. And Robert, thanks so much for the call.
Thank
I appreciate
you guys.
It.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a great question. This goes, I think, to the question I asked just a few moments ago when I was really weighing my words. Do you think this is a good move forward theologically? And you were very guarded in saying too much about that. Well, maybe not so. Just as Robert was indicating, people are leaving, LDS people, saying what a great time was had by all.
Yeah.
It probably wasn't because they thought their doctrinal toes were being stepped on, and so maybe not a lot of doctrinal progress was made here, but that doesn't mean this wasn't important or significant.
That's right. This was significant. I think we need to really look at this in a different way.
Strategically.
As a door that's opening for dialogue. In my experience, and I've done all kinds of counter-cult ministry, but the most effective thing I've ever done with the Mormons is this relationship kind of evangelism, making friends with them, getting them to trust me, and then hitting the hard doctrinal issues. Mm-hmm. If this is a step in that direction, I think it's dynamite. In fact, every time I interact with Mormons, it seems that, you remember those football games when we were a kid, you turn on a switch and the whole board vibrates,
yeah,
and the little guys
right.
run around some circles.
That's a precursor to video games.
That's
right. This is the old low-tech version.
every time I'm with a group of LDS discussing these things, if they sense they can trust me, man, it is like the board has been switched on and they're all mm-hmm. kind of vibrating in our direction.
Mm.
The more contact we have, and when we're secure about our beliefs and go in understanding what we want to accomplish with them, they seem to be rolling in our direction. Slowly, sometimes imperceptibly, but they're moving.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the move, and there are opportunities to take advantage of right
and
now.
So you see this, if I'm putting words in your mouth, then correct me, and I got to go to break in just a minute, but kind of in a word, you see the most significant thing about this move so far has been strategic. We are putting ourselves in position to make the blow. This isn't, in a sense, pardon the military metaphors here, but the blow, the coup de grace, as it were, we're still positioning, and this is vital to striking an effective blow for the kingdom. Is that a fair way of putting it?
You bet. In fact, I would love to see this be like an annual event of some sort.
Well, you said it,
yeah.
In fact,
yeah.
And it was funny because I saw the videotape of at least a section of it, and you said, and when you said that, everybody just burst into applause, and then you made some comment like, isn't there a larger place across the street?
Yeah, I was referring to their 21,000-seat conference center.
Yeah,
I'd like to fill that and get Lee Strobel in there to give a message on Jesus. I think that'd be dynamite.
Yeah, and of course they all laughed and applauded, and this line was picked up prominently by mm-hmm. the press, which every aspect of the press was there represented and covering this event for you on November 14th. So, Dr. Craig Hazen and the earthquake event on Temple Mount in Salt Lake City on the 14th of November. We'll be talking more about this and also trying to come to grips a little bit more with the Christians' response to Richard Mao's comments. I think we have to give that a little bit more opportunity to air, because there are a lot of people that are feel disenfranchised in this discussion. We want to bring them on board as much as possible if this is going to move together and move forward. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Don't dare go away.
How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise? It's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
Tired of defending your faith with, the Bible says so, does too, or I think it does? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Oh, come, all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant, O come ye, O come ye to Bethlehem.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and since this beautiful Christmas music is ringing in our ears, it's a reminder that Christmas is just around the corner, and I've been encouraging you to remember Stand to Reason this Christmas if we've been of help to you. I just had a thought about that a couple of days ago, and that is, I'm sure that many of you, I was reading a couple of cards that people have sent us of thanks, and it's just always great to hear the way that Stand to Reason has had a positive influence on your own life, whether through the radio or through our materials or through going to an event or personal interaction, whatever it happens to be. I pass those on to the rest of the staff because the whole crew is working hard together to help you to be a better ambassador for Jesus Christ. And it occurred to me, you know, maybe those of you who have already sent out your Christmas cards, you still got a couple extra ones laying around. Why don't you pick up one and write us a note and put it in the mail and just share your thoughts. You know, if you appreciate us, if we benefited you, we'd just like to hear about that. It's an encouragement to us, and that would be a gift to us this Christmas. And if you'd like, you want to put a check in there, that's fine. I'll give you the address. So you can mail that out to us. You can get it on our website, str.org. But if you want to mail it out, here's our address, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. I'll give it again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks. Talking with Dr. Craig Hazen, we're talking about Mormonism, particularly the role that he's played with a group of Christian academics, talking with a group of LDS academics, and the speech that was given by Rabbi Zacharias in this big event on November 14th, 7,000 people, a sellout crowd. They had to turn hundreds of people away from
probably
that.
Hundreds, yeah.
Yeah. And the impact that that's had, and it has raised some controversy. Most of the controversy revolves around the comment that Richard Mao, president of Fuller Seminary, made. I read that just a few moments ago. But there's a little bit of a controversy even about your prayer, Craig. And in your prayer, you make a statement. You start out, our Heavenly Father. This is your closing prayer?
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. As Craig, as part of this this group there that was on the dais, closes the event out, he says, "Our Heavenly Father, great King, our sovereign Creator and merciful Judge, Solomon asked for wisdom and you gave in abundance. Your servant James taught us that God will give wisdom generously to all who ask him for this precious gift." Now, those who are in called apologetics know the importance of that verse in James 1 to Mormons. And then you say, "Even the Mormon scriptures say that Joseph Smith Jr. sought wisdom at a crucial time in his life." And then you go on to finish your prayer.
It's funny how carefully I worded that, too. I thought that would be offensive to the Mormons, because I wasn't saying the Mormon scriptures, or this really happened. I'm saying, those Mormon scriptures, they say this happened.
Yeah. Right, right. And the irony is that it didn't offend the Mormons. It offended some Christians. This didn't bring the biggest... this was not the lightning rod. It was Richard Mao, but comments were made about that. And basically, it's like you're quoting Joseph Smith in a favorable light, which plays into their hands and doesn't help our situation at all. That's what they've said.
Yeah, in the general context, it was a call for people searching with all their hearts for wisdom, using their minds and everything at their disposal to discover the truth about God and his Son and salvation.
Right.
Seems to me it was a great opportunity to hit them with that right in their own turf.
Mm-hmm. Even where you start, our Heavenly Father, a term that means a lot to them, great King, sovereign Creator, merciful Judge, these are laden with Christian information. One thought that I had when I heard of the objections was, wait a minute, it's your prayer and God knows what you meant.
Yes.
So the prayer was to God, but some are concerned about the fallout and the wrong impression this might have given to others.
Yeah, there's always that danger in an event like that.
Mm-hmm.
I could have easily offended either side.
But you know what I thought of, though, in light of this concern? I thought of Paul on Mars Hill, where he said, he quotes their own prophets and writers favorably and kind of is trying to make common cause after fashion.
Right.
You're very religious, and you have this idol to an unknown God. He said, "That which you worship in ignorance, I now proclaim to you openly," which is what I think Rabbi Zacharias was attempting to do, speaking to the ignorance that they had, now proclaiming openly. Right. So it sounds like your prayer was in the spirit of Mars Hill.
That's exactly where I got it. Acts 17, that's where I went to look for, the elements of a prayer in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think that probably understanding that, a lot of the folks can be forgiving of that remark. I wasn't troubled by it, and I hope that they think in terms of Mars Hill there, because that's a legitimate way to approach. However, the Richard Mao comment, and I understand, you may not want to comment on this, and you can comment to the degree you want, but I have to ask the question about this and actually share some of my own thoughts, because I was troubled by Mao's comments.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because even if he didn't mean that false witness meant intent to deceive, it's very clear to me that this is the way it could have been taken, and in fact seems to have been taken by a lot of LDS people. And as much as he prepared his remarks in advance, he would have been well served to be more careful about his language. But he did write a rejoinder, a defense for his comments, and he talks about Dave Hunt, for example, who is a Christian writer who's written against cults. And in which he writes a whole book whose main thesis is that Mormonism is satanic in its inspiration and practice. And he says, this would be Mao of Dave Hunt, that this is bearing false witness. Now, here's why that troubled me. I read in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 a warning that Paul makes against those who bring another Jesus and false prophets and false apostles who teach another spirit, and even Satan himself disguises himself as an angel of light. And, when one reads that passage understanding about some of the details of Mormonism, you'd think that this is precisely the kind of thing that Paul was warning against. And one doesn't have to say that Mormonism is Satanism, which is a particular kind of religious expression, to say that it is a false religion and therefore inspired by an angel of light by Satan, which it seems to me Dave Hunt is saying, yet Richard Mao is trying to distance himself from that analysis. Would you be comfortable with Dave Hunt's analysis there, given as I've just read it?
Certainly, on one level. I think it's totally from the New Testament, Galatians and 2 Corinthians 11. These are very powerful statements. I think when you boil it all down, certainly, I actually believe that Mormonism is a tremendous achievement of the devil.
Mm.
You know, sometimes the devil is very clever about dancing right on the edge of what appears to be Christian. He's most effective in doing that. We need to be aware of that. And I actually discussed that with Mormons. However, perhaps, and I don't want to get in the position of defending Richard Mao. He's a big boy and he can do that himself. But just to look at it from another perspective, you know, I must, every other week I must talk to some Christian when they know, when they find out I know something about Mormonism. And they say really off-the-wall things to me about Mormonism. Like, oh, yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, don't they like, you know, deep down, aren't they worshiping the devil in the temple? Well, you know what? I don't think they're doing that.
Yeah.
But that's their impression. Where did they get that? You know, I don't know.
Somebody's
teaching
this.
Those kinds of things circulate.
Yeah. So your recommendation then for Christians who are in cross-cult ministries would be what, given what you know about the Mormon Church right now?
We do have to do our best to find out what it is they believe. Now, it's difficult to nail that down at points, but we have to listen carefully to them.
Would it be better to say, in as much as we witness to individuals, to ask the kinds of questions that Stand to Reason encourages people to ask, what do you mean by that, and how did you come to that conclusion, of the individuals involved to find out, in a sense, what kind of Mormonism they actually hold to?
That technique alone would transform the way we interact with Mormons. Rather than telling them what they believe, but, you know, doubtless you haven't read, you know, the church manual from 1837, you know, that says X, Y, or Z.
Doubtless.
And they haven't read these things. Yeah.
I had a fellow once ask me to if I could recommend a good book on Buddhism. And I asked him, why did he want to read a book on Buddhism? He said, because he had a Buddhist friend that he worked with, and he wanted to understand his views. And I said, the best way to understand your Buddhist friend's views is to ask your Buddhist friend, not to read a book on Buddhism, because chances are he doesn't hold to the view of Buddhism in the book anyway, especially if the book represents an Eastern Buddhism, from the source, as it were, and he's an American. And so this same thing seems to apply here. Instead of just understanding these ideas of Mormonism, quote-unquote, that would be maybe classical Mormonism or what has been understood to be that, most Mormons don't hold to that view. Better find out what they individually think.
That's right. In fact, on my analysis, reading some of the early apostles in the movement of the LDS Church in the 19th century, it is a very different ball game now than it was then. There have been some tremendous changes in attitudes, in things that they hold important, in things that they emphasize. We need to get the straight scoop to know which Mormonism we're actually talking to at the time, and that takes a little bit of time, a little bit of dialogue, and sometimes building relationship with these people.
Well, are there Mormons though that hold to the Mormonism that cultists understand to be Mormonism? I mean, there was a kind of a profile, and you read it, the books, and there are a lot of books out there. Walter Martin was one of them that kind of started the trend of educating Christians on these things. And does that Mormonism exist in some significant sense in your mind?
It does, but it's funny because it's a certain age range. The younger missionaries, when you talk to them about Mormonism, you're not going to get the sense that the kingdom of the cults analysis is really penetrating at that point. But when I talk to like middle-aged Mormons, maybe 50 and above, they seem to be talking about the kind of Mormonism that was actually addressed in the Kingdom of the Cults.
Well, don't these missionaries need to, I'm just wondering if missionaries to Christianity have to understand some pretty foundational things about the Christianity that they're communicating, or they're not going to be effective in communicating a message. So what is the message of the missionaries if it isn't something roughly orthodox, I guess, they're characterizing their view of the world, which taken in classical terms is rather unusual compared to Christianity, biblical Christianity.
Yeah, it's funny because much of our view of Mormonism is provided by these white-shirted, bike-riding missionaries who come to our door. And you know what? They know nothing about nothing, really, in terms of Mormonism. They just don't. They're 19-year-old kids who'd rather be doing something else generally, but they're, you know, they're doing their duty and doing their best. They've learned some basic lessons to provide, and they've practiced and practiced and practiced giving their testimony. And that's where it resides.
So ultimately, what it comes down to for Mormons, the apologetic is the burning in the bosom. It's classically communal, but it's just what God has done in their life and their personal convictions, which it's hard to argue against on that level. Right.
That's right. In fact, I had some missionaries come over the other day, and one of them had just gotten off a plane from Canada. This was his first stop as a missionary, and it was my house, you know. And so we sit down in the living room, and he's giving me his testimony, and we're chatting around, and I said, you know, I have some real doubts about, you know, what took place in the early 19th century. And this young fellow said, you know, I had doubts too. Yeah, yeah. And you know what I did? I prayed and asked God to sort it out for me. And I turned to him and I said, "Oh my goodness, God is answering your prayer right now." And then I launched into a Christian take on Mormonism. The guy was shaking when he left, yeah. And the poor guy. But they're young and they're 19 years old. And
okay, one last thing here. We just got a minute or two here. I want to James White, well-known Christian apologist, thinker, and 1 minute. Well, James is concerned. He's going to be speaking for us at the Master Series on a different issue, but James is concerned that the comment by Mao has really disheartened the Christian apologists because now he's kind of aided and abetted the enemy, as it were, and taken a shot at these guys that are really working hard based on something he doesn't really understand. You have a liberal Christian from a liberal institution, Richard Mao, with liberal theologians, and they're talking about these kinds of things, and you got all these other guys that are down in the trenches, have been working hard for years trying to make a difference, and now they are thoroughly disheartened, because they're discouraged to make an effort because this is all used against them. What do you have to say?
Well,
to them,
you know, even when he made the comment in the tabernacle, something inside of me, my heart went out to folks like Gerald and Sandra Tanner, people who've done such tremendous historical work that I believe helped push us to the place we are today, mm-hmm. in this new level of engagement with the LDS.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to say anything that would lump them in or even cause them to be dishonored in any way troubles me some.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad Rich Mao, although he made his statements, he came back with some sort of clarification on that, be that as it may. But
yeah, I'm not sure it helped much.
I'm not sure. But you know, I totally understand that could be dishonoring,
mm-hmm.
To the folks out there in the trenches.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got a word of encouragement for him?
Keep up the great work, guys. We all have to work together, and I hope they understand that really what we're involved in is a huge war here, where we've got people in the trenches. Not only that, we've got people who are doing peace talks too, who are engaging at the highest level, seeing if there's any way we can work out a lasting peace.
So we got a whole army here working, and everybody's got their job, and you're doing one part of it, and they're doing another part.
That's
we
right.
all work together,
and I'm one of them. I stay in the trenches too, so I honor what they do.
Craig Hazen, great to have you as a friend, as a brother in Christ, as a co-worker on the field of the kingdom of God. Good talking to you. More coming up next hour, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, Nancy Piercy and her brand new book on truth. It is really a stunner, a wonderful book, a must-read for 2005. We'll have her on the air, and you can hear what she has to say in just a moment. Greg Kokel with hour number two on Stand to Reason coming up. Hour number two, ladies and gentlemen. That wasn't my sentiment. The show is Stand to Reason. We talk about the critical issues of life. The world of ideas is special here. And this hour is going to be an excellent example of that. My guest for the next, actually, 40 minutes till the end of the show is somebody, frankly, I am terribly remiss and not having had on the show before. She has written extensively How Shall We Now Live, The Soul of Science. She's a visiting scholar at the Torrey Honors Institute at Biola, so that's close to home. She's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. She's a very perceptive student of culture in the spirit of Francis Schaeffer, and in fact, her heart beats in sync with Stand to Reason's. Speaking of Nancy Piercy, her new book is Total Truth. Nancy, I am so sorry it has taken so long to get you on the show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here now.
You guys, you're in such lockstep with us as I read your material, and especially this wonderful book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity. You have done a sensational job here. I'm going to tell everybody this is the book they need to read for 2005. If they only read one book, this is it. And you have done a great job in kind of capturing the issues here. What I want to start with here is I want to talk a little bit about the kind of what I think is the core idea, because it's a long book and you've covered a lot of bases here. It's very thorough. I want to talk about what I take to be the core idea here and then get into a little bit of the history of it so people can get their hands around it, okay? Is that all right with you?
That sounds good.
I have two quotes that I want to read to you, one that came out of the election and one that came out of the LA Times, and I think both of them say something about the main theme of your book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity. And the first quote is, now let me see if I can find it here. The first quote comes from John Kerry and in his concession speech. And I actually heard you offer this when I watched the TV presentation. I think you were you on a C-SPAN or Book, what was that, Book World or something like that?
It was C-SPAN. It was their program called Book TV.
Book TV, right. And you talked about this book and you said that John Kerry said this. He said, I'm quoting here from what you said, the problem with Bush voters, this in his concession speech, no less, the problem with Bush voters is that they are faith-based, not reality-based. And then I couple this from a recent letter to the editor who is in the LA Times, who's talking about moral values as a meaningless buzzword. Here's what he has to say. Moral values is the big post-election buzzword, but it's meaningless in this context because everyone votes according to his or her moral values always. Americans simply have no unified definition of what constitutes the moral position. Everyone votes according to his or her moral values. And calling moral values the unexpected player or saying their appearance in the exit polls gives the president a clear mandate is baloney. There's a kinship between these two statements, it seems to me, in the main point of your book.
Absolutely. I'm glad you pulled those out. That really does encapsulate the main theme of the book, which is why is it that Christianity has not been more powerful impact in the public square? And the main reason is just is this division that comes out in that quote. I don't think it was actually Kerry. I think it was a Kerry supporter.
Okay.
After his concession speech.
That would have been a very bold thing for John Kerry to say.
Yes.
So I'm sorry I misquoted you on that.
But it was one of his supporters, and it was right, it was during his concession speech. It was a comment that a supporter gave to a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the problem with Bush people is that they are faith-based rather than reality-based.
Mm.
And this is exactly the main reason that Christianity, that we as Christians have a difficult time being ambassadors out into the public arena of our culture. And that is, there's been a redefinition of truth. And the redefinition of truth says that things that like religion and morality and ethics are not really truths, not objective truths, as they were once thought to be, but are merely personal values.
Mm.
And the word values in modern culture means a subjective, private, personal opinion or experience. You know, something that may be very meaningful to me, something that may be part of our cultural tradition, but that is not objectively true. And, of course, we don't deal with private experiences in the public realm. In
mm-hmm.
the public realm, we want public reason, public truths, things that are publicly verifiable.
And this was the thing that this writer in the letter to the editor was getting at. Everybody's got values, and they vote. People vote according to their own values, and those values are private things. And so what's new talking about values? How is this time any different than any others? And he was kind of dismissing the impact of Christians voting on their values, on George Bush's values, as somewhat inconsequential and almost illicit because it's an imposition of this private, faith-based understanding of things into the public square.
Right. In one sense, we shouldn't even allow people to say my values and your values. Would we say my truth and your truth? Not if we're talking about something that is objectively true.
Yeah, but even that language has been co-opted, my truth, your truth. I noticed you mentioned in your piece on TV, and I thought it was a great application, maybe we'll get to more of this later, that we have to be careful even how we talk about these things, because we use language that allows people to read our comments in light of this, what you described, a fact-value kind of dichotomy.
That's right. I think this ties very well into the theme of your program because you talk so much about what it means to be an ambassador. And to be an ambassador means you have to understand the culture that you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand their language, their thought forms, their culture, and so on. Well, in the way that we become ambassadors for Christ, we may not have to learn a new language because, after all, our neighbors speak English, but they do have different thought forms,
mm-hmm.
and the meanings of certain terms have changed. If we're not aware of that, if we don't stay on top of that, we'll be using words in ways that don't communicate anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key ones is that word values. the word values, when we talk about being values voters, or vote your values, as so many people put it in the last election, we don't realize that to the non-Christian, in mainstream culture today, the word values has been redefined to mean something private and subjective, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Well-known author Alan Bloom, you remember his book?
Yes, Closing of the American Mind.
Right. In another place, he's written, every school child knows that values are relative.
Mm-hmm.
They're not based on facts, but are subjective, private experiences.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think part of this, vote your values, and I'm curious what your assessment of this is. Part of my reflection is that, because our culture is in a significant flux, and lots of things are changing, and ideas are underlying so much of what critical ideas, foundational ideas that you talk about in your book, Total Truth, are underlying a lot of this. I think that Christians have understood for a while, and even been victimized internally by this fact-value distinction. It strikes me that to some degree, the charge or the challenge during this election to vote your values was an attempt to try to reverse this trend we've seen so far. It's almost as if Christians were saying, I know you've been told that your values are things you keep to yourself in your private sphere, in your prayer closet, in your church, but you don't let them have an impact in the public sphere. Baloney, don't listen to that. Go ahead and vote your values. And so there's a little bit of an understanding there, an attempt to try to reverse this privatization of faith. Am I onto something there, do you think?
No, you're absolutely right. And my concern is just that when we speak to... See, if you're going to address a Christian audience, we can use in-house jargon, and we know what we're talking about, and that's fine. My concern is that when we go to the public arena and want to speak to the mainstream culture, then we have to understand when they are using terms differently. So that if we were to come into public as we do and say, okay, these are our values, these are things we hold dear, think of some of the typical rhetoric that Christians often use.
Mm-hmm.
These are the beliefs we cherish.
Our beliefs, right, that we cherish. Good, perfect. My faith.
I just heard a Christian leader say this. What about the beliefs we hold dear?
Mm-hmm.
When we use emotive language like that, that is a complete red flag to the non-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you see, I always knew it was just an emotional, mm-hmm. irrational, you know, knee-jerk reaction by a certain subculture. You know, it immediately gets categorized in their mind in this little slot that says, okay, one particular interest group, this is their little reaction,
mm-hmm.
emotional.
They almost take it as a signal, okay, I don't have to listen anymore because that person is simply reporting autobiography. This is their feelings, their kind of thing, and so I can just dismiss it as that.
Let me give you another example. This just came across my desk the other day. It was a clip from a British newspaper, and it was somebody talking to Richard Dawkins, who, as you know, is the arch-Darwinian.
Mm-hmm. Probably the leading spokesman for Darwinism in the world today.
And atheism.
Yes.
Right? And not only Darwinism, but the idea that Darwinism means atheism,
mm-hmm.
and that religion is, he has argued that teaching religion to children is a form of child abuse.
Yes, in fact, I think in the Los Angeles Times book review section of the paper this morning, there was a review of a new book that he has out. So.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, this was also a book review. But so he was asked by a Christian spokesman in Britain, would you really deny people these beliefs that give them comfort and consolation? Like, say, if they're facing something like a mortal illness,
mm-hmm.
would you really deny them that kind of comfort? And he sort of backed down and said, well, no, I wouldn't.
Mm.
But that's the wrong question.
Right, yeah.
As Christians, we shouldn't be saying, well, it may not be true, but it's a form of comfort and consolation.
Sure.
Let's let people have their irrational crutch.
Have their little placebo. I think it was Marx who said that religion was the opiate of the people, so we can have our little drug that makes us feel better.
And here's an example, again, of a churchman in Britain redefining religion, allowing religion to be redefined, using that language, letting it be co-opted by that fact-value split,
mm-hmm.
as a merely personal emotional value that, after all, we should tolerate in people who need that kind of thing.
Nancy...
We've given up the battle when we do that.
That's right, we have. Nancy, tell us just a little bit more, since this is so central to your thesis, about the fact-value split. Let me introduce just with this thought. I was talking to some friends of mine today, you know, and we deal a lot with postmodernism and relativism. I've written a book on relativism, and we deal with the emergent church, which is postmodernism in Christian circles to a great degree. And And I think the battle, I always like to try to reduce things to kind of their simplest form, you know, to begin working on them in this kind of broad sense. And if I were to reduce everything to what is the struggle here? What is the battle about? I think I would say that the word knowledge is the word that captures what this battle is about. What counts as knowledge? And it strikes me as reading your book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, that it is this word knowledge that this fact-value distinction spins on. So could you take a moment or hinges on? It's the fulcrum, so to speak. Could you just take a moment and just spell out the fact-value distinction a little more clearly so our listeners don't miss it?
Yeah, focusing on knowledge is a good idea. Basically, what you have to understand is every culture has its gatekeepers, right? The people who have control, access to the public arena, a public definition of truth. What's the cultural myth or the cultural story, the meta-narrative that defines our particular society? And what most people don't realize, though, is the key gatekeeper is not really any group of people. It's the definition of knowledge or the definition of truth. Because if an idea is not considered genuine knowledge, well, then it's going to be simply screened out.
Mm-hmm.
I like the way you put it a moment ago. Then it's just autobiography.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the definition of truth becomes the central gatekeeper. And in modern culture, the definition of truth is the fact-value split. And that's the idea that on the fact realm, well, if you can picture it in your mind, it sometimes helps. Francis Schaeffer introduced this concept using the imagery of two stories in a building.
Yeah, when I was listening to your presentation, by the way, before I read your book, I said, I hear Schaeffer in here somewhere, and you came right out with this wonderful illustration from Schaeffer.
That's right. He didn't use the contemporary terminology, but he did have that good image that helps people to get a mental image of what we're talking about. If you think of the bottom story, the lower story being facts, and that's science, that's public truth, that's verifiable. And then over against that is the upper story of values, which is subjective, private, and personal, non-cognitive. In modern culture, knowledge is associated strictly with the lower story. And what's in the upper story, which is things like religion, morality, and so on, and the arts and humanities, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Meaning, those kind. And there's no stairway from one to the other on this characterization.
They're
totally, in other words, values are not tied in the upper story, are not tied to anything by some people's characterization real in the lower story.
That's right. It's the dichotomy that's a problem. It's not saying, well, there's a difference between ethics and science. Of course there is. What's key is what you just said, that ethics and religion, morality have been cut off from any grounding in the real world where we can talk about how do we know it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one way to get a handle on it. In the older, a generation ago, a secularist was likely to argue that Christianity was false. And at least you could then debate with them over the meaning of true and false and how do we know and what are your grounds for knowledge and so on. Today, the challenge has shifted. Today, the secularist is much more likely to argue that Christianity does not have the status of a truth claim at all. And this is a much deeper challenge to Christianity.
Actually, what they would say is probably characterize it like this. Well, that may be true for you,
right,
but it's not true for me. And here they're talking about truth, small t, in the upper story, which are going to be different from everybody. Not so in the lower story, where you have the facts of the world as they really are, characterized by science. Nancy, we got to go to break here very quickly, but your book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, we have these at Stand to Reason. I think we have about 10 copies available. We can mail them out tomorrow. They'll be there for Christmas. This is a great Christmas gift. In fact, Nancy, I'm kicking myself because I sent some books out for gifts already in the mail of long distance, and I wish I would have sent this one, so maybe I'll send it post-Christmas. But you can call Stand to Reason during the day tomorrow, 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, and order it from us, and we will ship it to wherever you want us to ship it, and I have guarantees that it will be there by Christmas. So give us a call, 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason. We're going to break now. I'll be back with Nancy Piercy and Total Truth in just a moment.
Do you have an important decision to make in your life? Are you looking for God's guidance or leading before you move ahead with the decision you're currently faced with? Well, Greg's teaching on decision-making and the will of God, available on audio cassette or CD, takes you through the scriptures to provide the tools you need to make sound choices. After hearing Greg's teaching, you'll experience a deeper sense of relief and freedom in decision-making than you've ever known before. You'll understand how reading Scripture carefully makes a difference in many different issues, including making decisions. Decision-Making and the Will of God is available today from Stand to Reason in audio cassette or CD format. Extensive notes are included to help you with your study. Simply go to www.str.org or call the office at 800-2-REASON and order Decision-Making and the Will of God today. You'll be glad you did.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I usually do Sundays, 3 until 5. Well, today, 3 until 4:45, along with Nancy Piercy, who is giving you a piece of her substantial mind here, as she's done in her new book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity. Crossway Books has published this, and Crossway's come a long way. The first time I saw Crossway Books, Nancy, was when I saw Francis Schaeffer's trilogy reprinted by Crossway under one title, which it seems appropriate that you're publishing now with them, given the influence that Dr. Schaeffer's had in your life.
Yes, well, actually, Crossway began its book publishing arm explicitly to publish Schaeffer.
Is that right?
And this is the 25th anniversary of Crossway, so they too thought that this was quite appropriate that my book is coming out on the 25th anniversary of the company, when it in many ways takes Schaeffer's vision and updates it and shows how it applies to today.
Yeah, it does, and he was so prescient in his analysis. In fact, when I became a Christian in 1973, Dr. Schaeffer's works were among the first that I read, and everything in my life has been shaped by that. I'm so glad that the skilled pen of Nancy Piercy is now, in a sense, communicating those same truths in a way that's accessible to the 21st century mind. And what gets me is, as I was just telling some friends here in the studio, that because I read Schaeffer so early, not only have I not been confused about what's been going on with modern man, but I have not been confused about postmodern man either, because there's an interesting little twist with postmodern man, where modern man has this upper story, lower story dichotomy, and therefore all steps of meaning or statements of meaning must represent kind of a leap of faith out of the upper story with no connection to reality. You know, it's Kierkegaardian leap of faith. It's almost as if what postmoderns have done is now they deny the legitimacy of the lower story and say, as I put it, everything's ice cream. You know, it's all personal narrative. It's all personal stories. It's personal preference. Everything is utterly relativized. And so it, in a very odd way, it fits right in to Schaeffer's analysis.
It's fun to hear you say that. I became a Christian at 1972,
mm-hmm.
I guess it was. But I was at La Brie in 71.
I was there in 76, by the way.
Oh, okay.
But sure, I just was visiting for about a week, and I had a chance to hear Udo Mittelman do this sermon on a Sunday. And then one day during the week when Dr. Schaeffer would do his kind of fireside chat, he'd sit up on that huge mantle in the fireplace in the little cottage and chalet there in Huemo, Switzerland at La Brie, and I have a whole account I wrote of that. I have to go back and read it, but it was very challenging and stimulating, and it was grounding your understanding of 21st century Christian apologetics and thinking.
Well, actually, I became a Christian there. I went as a non-Christian in 1971.
As did many, huh?
Pardon me?
As did many people.
That's right. Back then, it was not considered a Christian study center, which is the way people tend to think of it today,
mm-hmm.
then it was genuinely evangelistic, and the majority of people were non-Christian.
It was a shelter, L'Abri.
L'Abri means the shelter.
Yeah. Now you, what's interesting about your treatment in this book, Total Truth, is that you not only point to the issue being knowledge and truth and this dichotomy of fact values, but you also say it's not only the culture in the broad sense that has been infected by this inappropriate distinction from a Christian perspective, but the church itself is deeply influenced by this same fact-value distinction, and boy, do I see that here. But there's a history to this, and the middle of your book may be the most important for a lot of our listeners because it tracks that history. Can you tell us a little bit about the history in the church, that in particularly the American church, that has led us to this position of being so comfortable living with this fact-value
That's
distinction?
Right. I'll start with an example and then show how we got there. One of the examples that I think illustrates it most strikingly is an article I clipped from a Christian magazine not too long ago, and it was written by a young woman who had just recently graduated from a Christian high school. And she said, on the first day of theology class, my teacher drew a heart on one side of the blackboard and a brain on the other side and said, the two are divided as the two sides of the blackboard. Heart is what we use for religion, and the brain is what we use for science.
Oh, that just makes me tremble. Just
it should.
Tremble. I mean, it's so bad. But that's
it is. What it means is that many of our churches and schools are turning out kids, young people, who are genuinely Christian in their religious life,
mm-hmm.
but who are completely secular mm-hmm. in their mental life.
But this dichotomy, even in the church, was a response to something earlier in the history of the church.
Right.
This has a history to it, kind of.
That's right, and that's what I was trying to understand, too, when I was writing the book. Where did this come from? Because if we understand the history, then it's easier for us to fight against it
mm-hmm.
and to correct it in our own day. And so I began looking at the history of evangelicalism in America. And what people call evangelicalism essentially grew out of the First and Second Great Awakenings, and which did a lot of good. They did an enormous amount of good. Thousands and thousands of people came to the Lord and were saved through the First and Second Great Awakenings and the mm-hmm. revivals. But it also came with some negative baggage, and that's what we still have to deal with today. And the negative baggage was that Christianity was redefined in terms of an intense emotional conversion experience.
By the way, was this more true of the Second Great Awakening than the First?
Much more.
Yeah, because George Whitefield, as I understand, was a principal in the First Great Awakening, which was largely a kind of a Calvinistic awakening. Would that be fair to call it that?
That's right. In the First Great Awakening, you see a lot of people who were wonderfully balanced between intellect, intellectual understanding of the faith, and a heart commitment, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
People like Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield. But there was still a certain amount of emphasis in their rhetoric in favor of the emotional experience, and that those seeds were planted and then really sprung up in the Second Great Awakening, which, as you noticed, was much more oriented towards redefining Christianity in terms of personal experience and downplaying theology and doctrine and the whole cognitive side of belief.
And this is where people would recognize the name Finney as being associated as a principal there.
Right. You have to realize that, I mean, most of us have even forgotten this. Unless you were raised in a liturgical church like I was raised Lutheran,
mm-hmm.
we've forgotten that for many people, raising someone in the faith meant learning the catechism, you know, memorizing the Bible, memorizing
mm-hmm.
the creeds, memorizing words to hymns that had a lot of content, very much teaching-oriented, and that the Christian nurture was considered a largely cognitive intellectual task, as well as, of course, the virtues and character and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the side that tended to get lost in the emotionalism of the revivalist movements. And that's what we're fighting with today, is we're left then with sort of a redefinition of religion in terms of the private experience. And certainly we're talking about the 19th century when we talk about the Second Great Awakening, and this was a period when the first really great intellectual challenges to Christianity were coming down the
That's
pipe.
That's right. Yeah, Darwinism. And the German higher critics and
exactly.
the effects of Hume and Kant and the others and the Enlightenment.
Right. And if you were defining Christianity merely in terms of your emotional experience, you had fewer and fewer resources to handle these great challenges. And, and what we see then, of course, is by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the church has pretty much turned in on itself. This was the fundamentalist period, where the mentality was circle the wagons.
Right. Jesus is going to come back. Let's just hold out until then. You know, the interesting thing is that the discussion in the hour just before you with Dr. Craig Hazen and Biola was about Mormonism and some things that are happening in the Mormon church that we think are really good. But they're creating some conflict even in our own circles. And the irony is that though we fault Mormonism for kind of falling back on a burning in the bosom as their chief apologetic for their view, which we think puts them at risk for getting it wrong, what you're saying is the very same thing is happening in most Christian churches as a result of this change in epistemology we see in the 19th century.
Yeah, there was another similarity too, interestingly enough. Another tendency of American evangelicalism was to be very anti-historical, was to throw out the whole heritage of the Christian church, was to regard history as so much accumulation of error and corruption and so on, and to think that we could cast all that aside and go back to the primitive church and recreate it.
Which is what the project for Joseph Smith actually was.
Right.
Restoration.
Sometimes called the thesis of the fallen church, and it's the idea that the church fell away hopelessly at some point in history and needed to be restored. You know, we could just get rid of all these intervening centuries. That was a common theme at the time, and it was picked up by Joseph Smith, and it was also picked up by a lot of evangelicals.
Campbell, with the Restoration movement on the evangelical side.
Right, and the point being not that we shouldn't fight corruption, of course we should, but the point being that for many of them, then they lost the rich heritage of the great minds of the church by thinking you could simply toss out all those intervening centuries. You got rid of, well, you got rid of the church fathers, Augustine.
Right, yeah. And this leads to another thing that I want to pick up when we return from the break, and that is what one person called the
democratization.
Thank you. There it is. Democratization of truth. And boy, is this significant. When we return, we'll talk more about that word that I couldn't pronounce that Nancy could. My guest, Nancy Piercy, the book Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity. I said early in the interview that this is the book you want to read in 2005. It really tells the story. It's so adequate to, I think, ground in very solid thinking and in history and with good theology, the conflict, the cultural conflict that we're facing right now, which is fundamentally a conflict of ideas. I hope you get the book one way or another. We have them at Stand to Reason. If you call in early tomorrow, 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, we have 10 copies, I think, on hold there, and we will be glad to send them out. You'll get them by Christmas. But if you don't get it from us, get it from someone. Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, Crossway Books, the author Nancy Piercy. And we'll be back with Nancy in just a moment when we return on Stand to Reason.
How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise? It's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
Tired of defending your faith with, the Bible says so, does too, or I think it does? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and co-workers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Baby Jesus, pa-rum-pum-pum-pum. I am a poor boy too, pa-rum-pum-pum-pum.
Greg Kogel back with you here on Stand to Reason.
No gift to
and I'm having a sensational time. I'm just sorry that this is a short hour for us. My guest, Nancy Piercy, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I'm just ashamed of myself. After all these years on the air, Nancy, it's taken us so long to get you on the air, and you've been making such a contribution for so long. We actually met twice. The second time you might recall, which is just a couple of months ago over at Biola.
That's right.
And you had done that presentation. We had a nice little chat then, but then we had met years ago, early 90s, when you were working for the Colson Organization, and I was being interviewed as a ghostwriter for the Breakpoint, which were you the founding editor, as I recall.
The founding editor, right, and the executive editor for about 9 years.
Yeah, and it was just a brief meeting then, but I remembered you.
remember you too from that time, definitely.
Well, it was just a quickie, but in any event, I'm glad to have you on now, and for the work that you're doing. The book, of course, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, and I mentioned this is the one book you want to read, friends, if you read one book for 2005, because this will give you everything, the philosophic foundation, the historical foundation, the biblical foundation of a Christian worldview, spoken and written so well by Nancy Piercy from the tradition of a Francis Schaeffer, so prescient in anticipating not just the modernism of the 20th century, which he was in and writing to, but anticipating the postmodernism of the 21st century. We broke off last segment with that hard word, democratization of truth. What does that mean?
Yes. What it means is we have to realize that American Christianity is not identical with classic Reformation thought. I think we tend to think it is, but American Christianity is different, and it was shaped in many ways by the American Revolution. The American Revolution was much more radical, I think, than many people realize, in the sense that it inspired, it became the paradigm that was applied everywhere. Not only to religion, not only to politics, but also to the church. A lot of people at that time really felt that this was a starting civilization over again. We're going to cast out the past. The past is hopelessly corrupt, and we can start things over again. We have it in our power to begin the world over again, as Thomas Paine put it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was if we could start a civilization, a state over again, why then, why not the church?
And that was the great American experiment when it comes to America. But the same ideals were motivating the church in early America as well, is what you're saying.
That's right. And it was the idea that we could just start the church over again. But you see, what impact that has on the life of the mind, which is my concern, you know, Christian worldview, the impact on the life of the mind was that it essentially cast aside centuries of the great thinking, the great theological reflection of the church. Many Americans cast out even the Reformers. Reformers weren't nearly radical enough.
Hmm.
You know, they cast out a Luther or a Calvin. They cast out the church fathers, as we said right before the break, like Augustine or Tertullian, Aquinas. Instead of dealing with these people, they're not perfect. You know, we're Protestants, so we don't believe they're infallible.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the way to hone your own mind is to wrestle with the greatest thought that's been offered in the past.
The old books that C.S. Lewis wrote about.
That's right. I love that essay that he wrote where he said, it's almost impossible not to be captured by the spirit of your own age unless you have some alternative standpoint from which to evaluate it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the old books give us, as he put it. You should always read the old books because they give you a different perspective. They give you freedom from the accepted, you know, accepted truisms of your own age.
Right.
So my point has not to do so much with theological authority of the past, but with the impact that it had on the life of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That it was greatly, American thought was greatly impoverished because of this rejection of history.
So it's almost like if you start to try to reinvent the wheel, then you make a lot of the same mistakes as the early guys took thousands of years to rectify. And in this particular case, you have this democratization of truth, this high individualism that drove the American enterprise, now driving American religion.
Yeah, and democratization meant essentially each person can decide for themselves what Scripture really teaches. There's no notion of theological authority left or church authority, where there's something outside my own mind. You know?
Yeah.
And if this is taken utterly consistently, most churches it's not. I mean, most people may pay lip service to this, but let's face it, most of us still accept the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed and the Athanasian Creed, the great creeds that show the church historically hammering out the doctrine of the dual nature of Christ, the Trinity, and so on.
We don't know what those things say, but we do accept them, right?
We do accept them. Whereas if you were utterly consistent, you'd have to say each person's reading of Scripture is exactly equally valid to anyone else's. It's essentially a kind of theological relativism applied to the church.
You tie this to Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, thinkers of the 19th century that really were significant, maybe the 18th century, in social contract mentality that has influenced the church. And it tied to this thing.
Yeah, I think this is one of the key things in understanding what's distinctive about the American mentality over against, you know, European and classic thought. And that is the social contract theory, Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau, was essentially started as a way of getting an alternative to a Christian social theory.
Hmm.
What it was saying is after the religious wars of the 16th century, people saw that Christians were willing to shed blood over theological differences. And therefore, a Christian vision of justice or the right, capital R, the right, could not be the basis for society anymore. Up until then, it was thought that a civil society is a moral entity. It's got to be based on moral principles like justice. And what these guys were saying was, wait a minute, all of our moral principles come from Christianity, and those Christians are killing, you know, slitting
right, right.
throats. Therefore, we need to find a non-moral basis for society and get rid of any religious, ultimate religious basis for society.
Mm-hmm.
So what if they said, well, okay, you've got people, let's hypothesize an alternative origin story. Instead of the origin story of Genesis, which starts in the Garden of Eden, we'll talk about a state of nature. Individuals running around in a state of nature. And what do they do in the state of nature? Well, they're all killing each other, according to Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a...
Nasty,
it's,
poor, brutish, and short kind of thing.
It's essentially bestial, you know,
yeah, right.
A little more than beast. And well, then what do we do to avoid killing each other? Well, we come together, and out of self-interest, we form a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So this becomes the basis of civil society.
So instead of being
civil societies from God and ultimately is based on religious notions of morality, now it's merely a naturalistic view of individuals coming together out of self-interest.
So I'm jumping in here because we got about just a minute and a half to go. Sorry to say, but so this really becomes the kind of the cultural momentum philosophically that drives the church in a very individualistic way here in the 20th and now the 21st century, where truth becomes individual and we highly individualistic in the way we approach our Christianity, and therefore very subjectivistic in terms of the Christian, what truth is.
Right. You see, the social contract theory assumes that the ultimate realities, socially speaking, are individuals, only individuals, and that anything that binds us together in civil society is a matter of individual choice. Where do things like marriage come from? Well, we choose them. Family, we choose it.
Of course, we hear that with same-sex marriage.
We can redefine it. At any time, we can redefine it by choice as well then, which is, this is the fundamental worldview underlying the homosexual marriage movement today.
30 seconds, Nancy. Sorry to ask you to do this in such a short a time, but your antidote.
The antidote. Well, in this case, it's recovering the Trinity.
Hmm.
Christian view of social institutions. institutions, whether it's civil society, whether it's the church, it's the Trinity. In the Trinity, you have three persons bound into one.
Mm-hmm.
Unity is just as real as the diversity, as the individuality. And so this gives a basis for saying things like family are just as much real, and marriage is just as real as the individual.
Nancy, thank you so much for your hard work with your book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity. And I do look forward to seeing you again here in Southern California and having you on the show again.
Can I give people the website?
Okay, go ahead, quickly.
www.totaltruthbook.com.
Well, that's easy. www.totaltruthbook.com. And Nancy Piercy is the author. Crossway Books is the publisher. This is the book to read for next year, and 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, tomorrow gets you 1 of 10 copies if you're the first to order it from us. We'll get it to you by Christmas. That's all the time we have for the show, friends. It has been a great, stimulating couple of hours with you. I look forward to next week. This week, be a good ambassador, especially as we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ. Merry Christmas, everybody. Bye-bye.